There we go. It's been a while since I've been at the main board. Coming back from break is so hard. Anyway, you're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me today is...
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep.
How am I coming in there, Open Sources?
Yeah, you're coming in very, very well from...
Oh, that's good. I'm calling from quarantine. I don't know if people know this, but I'm at a remote location as to, you know...
You're calling from Saturn 9?
Yes, I'm calling from
Saturn 9. Come in, Saturn 9. Anyway, it's always fun when we get to play pretend on our very serious news and politics show. But no, seriously, Scotty is in quarantine. He has the canine flu. We were talking about it off air. Anyway, CFRU is the station. You're listening to Open Sources, which is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. And you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. How you doing there, Saturn 9?
Still here. Can you hear me?
We can. I just...
I've turned into an English man with all the cold medication I've taken, but yeah, I don't know what happened.
News from away. Speaking yes. of news while we were away, we're going to talk about the curious case of Joshua Boyle, who just a few months ago was the humble former prisoner of the Taliban. Now he's a prisoner for actual crime, and we'll talk about how and why this story took a sudden turn that it did. And then we'll look at the reaction to the minimum wage hike here in Ontario and why everyone from Tim Hortons to Pizza Hut to the U of G, and especially the media, has got it all wrong. And then finally, we'll look at Toronto Mayor John Tory's response to the extreme cold weather, although we are currently on hiatus from winter, and whether or not his slow reaction might cost him some points in the coming municipal election. But first, since we're back, and the Trump show kind of went on hiatus while we were away at the holidays. He took some time for golfing vacation, not a working vacation. So he comes back to work, quote-unquote work. We'll get into that in a sec. But last week, we get this book, this huge book, Fire and Fury, released by a journalist named Michael Wolff, which is an inside look, reputedly to be an inside look at the goings-on in and around the Trump White House. Because everything in Trump world moves at, like, light speed, you may not have heard about, like, recent developments, and it's kind of all legislative. And I don't know if, Scotty, if you've been paying attention to the news from quarantine.
That's all I've been watching. That's all I've been – well, not completely, but I did hit the Netflix once. But, yeah, it's hard to avoid. So.
You took a break from Stranger Things or something and –
Yeah. And got all caught up. So this story came screaming out of the gate this past weekend. Michael Wolff obviously making the rounds and came up to Canada as well. He was on the CBC. That's where I saw him yesterday.
Oh, good for
the
him.
The explosive book. Fire and Fury. What a fantastic name. And I guess the side story is that a Canadian book called Fire and Fury has seen a boost in sales due to the unoriginality of naming convention of books. But Wolff is saying that you, meaning us, should believe every word that's in this book, and supposedly he has the tape to back it up.
Mm-hmm.
Although Trump and company have called it a garbage book.
They've called it like tabloid. They've called it every name in the book, basically. But anyway, keep going.
So I think Wolff's main point was that he said that he was asked by several people, well, who do we believe? And he says, well, everybody is lying. And he means everybody in the Trump administration in their own particular ways. So he's kind of taken a bunch of stories and interviews and kind of synthesized this book out of that. At least that's the impression I get. He's sort of distilled mm-hmm. it down to the most the salacious parts, I guess, the juicy parts. I'm sure it's not all juice. But, of course, out of this... The main thing to come out of this within days was the much publicized fight, I guess, with Steve Bannon
mm-hmm.
Over his comments regarding Ivanka, the son-in-law, saying, and Donald Jr. in particular, he kind of slammed Donald Jr. saying,
crack that, like an egg.
Crack like an egg, there you go. And the Russian meeting
TV.
Was,
yeah,
the Russian meeting was treasonous. So Trump, of course, comes back with his nickname. When he doesn't like you, you immediately get a nickname. So Bannon has become Sloppy Steve.
Sloppy
and
Steve.
Sloppy Steve tried to walk back his comments, but obviously not fast enough. Don't run. So he's finished at Breitbart as well, which was surprising. But I guess once you become a toxic property in this game, then you're done. So he's finished with that. I'm sure financially he's fine, but terms of...
He just dresses like he's homeless. He's not going to be actually homeless.
Exactly. That's his style, man, the two shirts.
But, I mean, the interesting part about that is, don't worry about Steve Bannon. He's going to be all right. The thing about him being fired from Breitbart is that he kind of made Breitbart what it is. I mean, Breitbart's been around for years because of his name for an actual person named Andrew Breitbart, who was a hard right sort of blogger commentator, probably still more moderate than the people currently running Breitbart. But then Steve Bannon comes aboard with the assistance of the Mercer family, who are one of these incredibly rich conservative families who are trying to use their wealth and power to reshape America in the Bannonian mold, if that's a thing. But he became a liability because he did not give fealty to the dear leader. It is kind of interesting in terms of people have been wondering, is Trump like the totem and people would follow the real power, quote unquote real power, which was like Bannon and Breitbart, or is the base with Trump and anyone who gets thrown under the bus for going against Trump gets rightfully under the bus? Everyone takes a turn running them over, and now we know the answer. It is to Trump. People are loyal, even people like the Mercer family, who have the ability to align as they see fit, given their money and status and influence.
And are the Mercers the ones that have pulled their funding? Somebody who's bankrolling Breitbart has pulled a ton of money, one of the billionaires.
The Mercers are the ones who bankroll Breitbart, and I think that their continued funding was sort of contingent on Bannon going out the door. Because this is the thing about Breitbart, is that there have been people in the States who have been trying to undermine advertising on Breitbart. Sleeping Giant is what the group's called, and what they do is they go on social media and they flood the social media feeds of different advertisers saying, hey, do you know your ads are on Breitbart? Because what happens is people buy ads and algorithms do their thing online and they pop up on certain sites. And so what they do is they go to these advertisers and say, hey, Tide, for example, do you know that I don't know why I thought of that first, but did you know your ads are popping up on Breitbart? And if Tide is run by any kind of human being at all, they will be gassed and appalled by that. And then we'll go and say to Google or whoever, hey, don't make sure our ads do not appear on this Breitbart thing. And that was showing a great deal of success, and which is why the Mercer funding is so critical to Breitbart's ongoing existence, let's say.
Yeah, so there's obviously a huge wad of cash behind all the players here. Mm-hmm. And of course, what happened on the weekend and is ongoing too was Trump's full throttle Twitter defense of his own validity, I guess. Not just Twitter, but also at press conferences, where he's the greatest and how smart he is. Alluded to the genius level comments before. Business savvy, he's popular.
Yeah.
And that just kept going like way too long, dude. Like you're far too defensive, really.
Right, and that led to the Monday thing, which was this like for an hour he had TV cameras in as part of this bipartisan meeting with Democratic and Republican congressional leaders, where they were talking about DACA, which is the act that will hopefully give some legal coverage to 800,000 they were kids when they were brought to the United States, but now they are young people with jobs and bills and taxes and lives and families of their own who, are looking down the nozzle of being deported at the beginning of March. and from the country that the only country they've ever known, because some of them came when they were infants or, you know, from the age of 5, 6, 7. How much do you remember from grade 2? And so
one thing.
Exactly. So, you know, they're trying to figure out how to keep these people, because Trump euphemistically last fall said, oh, Congress will figure it out by March. And of course, they still haven't figured it out. And at this meeting, quite famously, Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, comes out and says, what would you think about if we did a clean bill? Clean bill meaning with nothing attached, meaning no funding for walls, let's say. Just vote on DACA straight up. Yeah. And Trump's like, yeah, let's do that. And,
and his side of the table went, what?
Yeah, right. And then Kevin McCarthy, who's the House leader, Republican House leader of the Senate, is like, well, Mr. President, don't you think? And it was kind of interesting watching. And then after that, you had the transcript from the meeting come out with that interaction erased from the public record, which then had to be swiftly put back in, because as if anyone was going to forget that happened.
So since he called the cameras in, there's a full record, obviously, right? But,
yeah. And then the next day he goes on TV and is like, I've gotten a lot of letters praising me for and it's like, no, you didn't. Like, really? He said all the anchors sent me letters, and it's like, really? All the anchors, like,
went back
to their office and wrote a letter like it was 1896.
Dear Mr.
President, I just watched your interrogative on the Cable News Network, and I was most impressed. Yeah, no, that didn't happen.
It's like Detective Murdoch style attack. They spoke to a lot of DACA children, now young people, on the news, and I'm telling you, every single person they spoke to is somebody that I would want to come to my country.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like, why are you holding out? They're all, obviously not all of them, but Trump's implication all along is that these people are a burden to the system.
And right.
They're all, anyone that was on was talking, well, I went to college and I did this and I'm trying to better myself. And I mean, with any group, there is going to be a percentage where, you know, there probably are some shirkers or whatever, but it's obviously not anybody that the media spoke to. Now, maybe Trump would say that was fake news, or they just found the good ones because the rest are bad. I don't know.
Bad hombres.
But,
yeah.
yeah, I think it's a bit mind-boggling when you hear the DACA story, and it's like, and it was weird watching Trump soften just from what people were saying. He's like, right. Okay. Well, maybe we'll do this. Like, oh boy.
Well, it was weird. I mean, this is where kind of the implications of the book were sort of came into real life play, and people can sort of see the reality of it, where Donald Trump coming into the situation or any situation without having done any reading, without having done any research, without really having any opinions of his own, can be sort of led along by a string by anyone who's talking to him at any given time, which is fairly dangerous in terms of, you know, what if the wrong people talk to him? And there are plenty of wrong people in the White House right now, and I'm looking at you, Stephen Miller. But it's kind of scary. Because the one thing everyone in that book seemed to agree on, and that really no one's refuted at all, because, you know, in so much as Bannon was apologetic, he did not refute anything that book said that he said he said. But it's if everyone agreed on one thing, it's that Donald Trump is unfit for the job, and to which I say, no kidding. Anyway.
Yeah, and I guess the results of the physical will be out this week sometime, right? Or so that'll be more fodder for the weekend, I guess, to see.
I don't know if the results will be out. I know the physical's happening tomorrow at Bethesda.
Oh, it's happening tomorrow.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll invite the cameras in for that, too, which would be quite frightening, I think.
No, thank you.
No, exactly.
I did want to get to the breaking news, too, which is that it looked like the Democrats and Republicans do have a DACA deal that now has to go to leadership and the White House for potential approval. I haven't been able to keep up just because I was working on something else before the show, but we'll see what happens there. So there might be a light at the end of the tunnel for that. Who really knows, though, unfortunately. Speaking of things we don't know, you may remember Joshua Boyle. I feel very like very much like Larry King, like sitting here in this studio by myself talking to people on the phone, like Bismarck, North Dakota, hello. Anyway, that's a little aside.
Do you have a gold mic or?
I keep asking Christopher, and he says it's not in the budget. Anyway,
we'll have to have a fundraiser for that.
The gold mic-a-thon. Mark your calendars. Anyway, Joshua Boyle, he and his family were released from Taliban custody. It was actually a Taliban-affiliated group, but for these purposes, we'll call them the Taliban. They were in custody for 5 years. He is a Canadian. She was an American. They were evidently backpacking in southeastern Asia when they, according to Joshua Boyle, sort of accidentally somehow didn't realize they were crossing the border from Pakistan into Afghanistan, and they were taken into Taliban hands, where they suffered various indignities, but still also gave birth to three children. They returned to Canada in October. A lot of fanfare was made about their bravery and about their how difficult it was for them, and how they're trying to get back to a normal life, and how they're seeing kind of a normal family life for the first time. And then that brings us to New Year's Day, when Joshua Boyle was arrested on 15 counts, including 8 counts of assault, 2 sexual assault, 2 of unlawful confinement, 1 for uttering threats, 1 for mischief, which I gathered was trying to convince an officer that someone was trying to commit suicide or something, and then 1 count of admitting a noxious substance. So this is a pretty terrible story that's also become political because of the fact that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau met with the family just before the charges were announced, apparently while Joshua Boyle was under investigation.
Yeah, I think they're trying to place a lot on Trudeau that maybe doesn't really apply, because anybody who's freed from that kind of captivity would definitely meet with somebody higher up in the government. Now, as to whether this is the usual photo op thing that Trudeau seems to like with mm-hmm. a baby in it, right. Or is it just sort of a run-of-the-mill thing? Because, you know, anybody released from that kind of, presumably, allegedly, in 5 years in custody, and that's, I say allegedly because I think the best analysis I read of this was Rosie DiMiano in the Toronto Star, and she said, so much of this story doesn't make sense. There's a lot of, beyond the charges, I'm talking about beyond, I mean, the charges are one thing, but the story leading up to that, mm-hmm. It's not even holes, it's kind of like, okay, what made you go on this, it changes, it's like, well, it was a pilgrimage, or we were helping people out in the area, in the Afghanistan area, we were helping villagers, there was one story saying that Boyle said that he wanted to be a journalist.
Right.
So there's three stories right there. And going back in time a little bit, Boyle's first wife was Omar Khadr's sister.
Right.
So, you know, unlike her brother, seems to still be...
She's a hardliner. Yeah.
Still seems to be a bit of a Taliban advocate. She hasn't really renounced the Taliban. It's just odd. And it sounds like... Boyle was involved with his now wife at the same time he was married to Omar Khadr's sister.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like there's a lot of overlap of like, okay, so what actually happened? Mm-hmm. And not only that, she was supposedly pregnant when they went on this pilgrimage or hike or whatever.
Yeah.
It, you know, in an area like that, I think the Canadian government, among others, advised people not to go into areas like that, pregnant, not whatever. It's like, just stay out of there, will you?
Yeah.
And but they went anyway.
Yeah.
So, and normally, like, it looked like they lost a lot of weight in captivity, and supposedly one of their children was killed
mm-hmm.
or died in captivity.
Mm-hmm.
And his wife was assaulted by the sounds of it.
Mm-hmm.
But and I'm not saying that didn't happen, but it's just there are a lot of holes. As I said, there's lots that doesn't make sense, and I wonder if when the trial does happen for these other charges that have happened in Canada, will some of this start to come out? Like what really happened? I don't know.
Right. It's yeah, and on top of that, there was the McLean's profile. which came out like a couple of days after he was arrested, that showed him, like, you know, telling his wife to stop talking or to get permission from him before she answers at, like, follow up questions, which is
at
also
the press
kind of
conference,
disturbing.
Yeah, or something. Yeah,
yeah. It's just it's so weird because. And again, this is kind of where the media plays a part. And Jesse Brown talked a lot about this on Canada Land last week, that people just kind of took the story as gospel, or at least the press did. I think the press was a bit hesitant about kind of testing the, I mean, because these, the holes, as you said, in the story have been there from the word go. But there's definitely been some hesitation to sort of probe it, I guess just because of, you know, maybe Canadian politeness and given the things they talked about experiencing, you probably don't want to dig into it any further. But, I mean, this definitely shows that there were real questions that needed to be asked and answered, and no one was really asking them. And that includes, it seems, people in the Prime Minister's office who okayed the meeting. Although I will note, and I think this has been missing to a degree, that I don't think any of the pictures that were released were done by the PMO. I think those were all from Boyle's end, from his side. Those weren't, I mean, because they don't look like official PMO pictures in terms of being high quality. So I do wonder if there was maybe someone in the PMO that said, like, no pictures. We're just going to do it quiet. No pictures, okay? We don't want to exploit. And they would say that in quote marks. We don't want to exploit them. But I do wonder if certain protections were taken so that when this did come out, it did not blow back as badly on Trudeau as it might have.
Yeah, and something surfaced today. I saw it just before airtime that Boyle has, or somebody in the family has released a picture of, it's not of Boyle with Trudeau, but it was something to do with the famine in Darfur, the situation in Darfur, and Boyle was there. Yes. I don't know if he was doing his sort of, I want to be a journalist thing and taking pictures of it. It's not exactly a meeting because, you know, as we know, anybody can go to anything and take pictures. So it's not as if there's like a connection there.
I can speak from personal experience on that.
Me too, actually, come to think of it. Yeah.
I think that, it was a 2006, it was a demonstration or something in Toronto. And I think it was organized by Romeo Dallaire, a well-known former lieutenant general in the Canadian Forces, and Trudeau happened to be there. This was long before Trudeau got into politics himself, or at least in official capacity as a Liberal politician.
Yeah, he's testing the waters, I think, at that point.
Yeah, because I think
he wasn't elected. He's just a guy.
Right. I think that was, he first ran in 08. This was 06. So, yeah, he would have been definitely in the water testing phase. And Romeo Dallaire was there, and Joshua Boyle was there. And from what I gather, too, that these, one of the reasons we kind of know about this is because he took those pictures and they're used on the Wikipedia pages for both Trudeau and Dallaire. And so he's, I guess, one of his hobbies is like editing Wikipedia pages, and so there's kind of maybe a bizarro fascination there, or maybe this idea that maybe he was a political himself. I'm not sure, but I mean, that's another unusual piece to an unusual story.
Yeah, so I don't know if, going back to the charges, there's been a publication ban on the victim's identity, so it's not a certainty that it is his wife, Caitlin Coleman, or the kids, or it's unknown as of yet as to who.
It's definitely sensitive if there's a publication ban, though.
Yeah, because supposedly one of the comments from his wife, Caitlin Coleman, was that the trauma and strain of everything that happened has affected his mental state. But I get the impression that his mental state may have been affected before that. Now, maybe it's not my place to speculate on that, but there seems to be this kind of... I don't know. It's the unknown. Like, well, what? Like, what we actually? Supposedly, they met on a Star Wars gaming forum, which I thought was interesting. And I guess people meet on gaming forums and get
married.
No problem.
It happens.
Yeah. So, and it's unknown as to whether, I think the media were trying to get it out of Boyle, as to whether he had converted to Islam or not, because I believe he was raised Christian and homeschooled. He's from Breslau, so he's from down the road. It's not like...
Yeah.
Well, he's sort of local, I suppose. He's not from Toronto, but...
Local-ish, yeah.
I would assume Mennonite, but I'm not sure.
Well, yeah.
I'm speculating now, but I shouldn't. Allegedly. Yeah.
It's possible.
So I think this is one of those... There's more to come on this one. So I'm not. Did you happen to catch when the trial was going to happen? Or?
I don't know when the trial. It seems like they're in like the pre-trial phase right now because he was in court Monday. He's going to be in court again. Well, he was via video last Monday, this past Monday, he's going to be in court again this coming Monday.
He's not out on bail, is he? Or?
Oh no,
no, he's in custody.
He's being held. And then, yeah, I'm not sure when the trial's going to be after that. But, you know, one thing I'll say is that I'm not sure this Tim Powers, who's like a conservative operative. I was reading a Hill Times editorial he wrote where he made like a pretty strong allegory to Homeland, which if you've never seen Homeland, it's about a man who was a prisoner of war and then he returns home and he's been basically turned into a Manchurian candidate with some self-awareness of how and why he's been turned. And I don't think this is that. Let's just say that.
No. And hopefully for everyone's sake, the truth will come out. I don't know if that's going to involve getting people from... It has to be very difficult to get people from Afghanistan. And he also spent some time in Pakistan to testify via video link or otherwise. But remains to be seen.
It does. So we're going to take a break right here, and it's going to force me to push some more buttons, which I might be still rusty with. Whoa.
Push the rusty button.
Push the rusty button. That should go on a t-shirt. So we're going to take a break, play some music, and come right back, and we're going to talk about minimum wage and homelessness in Toronto. And that should be fun. Anyway, you are listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I was worried there for a sec. I was worried.
Sorry about that. Some sonic feedback from Saturn V, yeah.
No worries. That was Raisin Heck with their album, or maybe that's what the album's called. Yes. I am.
Is it Onion Honey? I'm guessing.
It is Onion Honey, yes.
It's Onion Honey, there you
Raisin
go.
Raisin Heck, and that was 500 Miles, and that was from their new CD, which is new into the station. Local-ish outfit. I don't know if they're from Kitchener-Waterloo, but this was recorded in Kitchener-Waterloo.
I believe they are, if not Cambridge. I'll take folk music for 100 points, please, Adam. There you go.
All I'll say on this is what happens when Scotty is sick and the music is left purely in my hands. Is what I just go
no,
to
ex-
the, I just go to the end of the new release shelf and then just get what's there and then I and then banjos happen is all I got to say.
Excellent choice. Excellent.
Oh well, there you go. We're going to talk about stuff. Minimum wage. I don't like doing everything by myself. Anyway, minimum wage went up to $14 on January the 1st. And that's when Kathleen Wynne personally and with vindictiveness crashed the Ontario economy, which is pretty much the message of any news outlet that covers the minimum wage hike. I disagree.
What's that movie with the father and the son and the shopping cart and it's the apocalypse?
Oh, The Road.
Yeah, it's like The Road, right? It's exactly like that.
Yeah.
You're just living off Twinkies and running around going, oh, the whole universe is falling apart. No, as we know, the universe has not fallen apart.
Yeah.
Adam, did you make it to the protest yesterday?
I did make it to the protest yesterday.
You did. Tell us a little bit about that.
It was what? It was covered by, I think, literally everyone. So it's pretty easy to find any and all details online. But it was probably about 2 dozen people, a lot of the usual labor suspects here in town, and it was there was a lot of energy. And I think what it was mostly just about raising awareness and mission accomplished. By the way. There was somebody there who, former member of OTSSF, or OSSTF, I should say. I'm getting
the teachers union. Yeah,
the secondary school teachers federation.
Yeah.
She is retired now, but she goes to that Tim Hortons, and I did ask Janice Folk Dawson of the Guelph and District Labor Council why that Tim Hortons, and she said it was because. It was one of the busier ones in Guelph, and it was kind of adjacent to the university where, you know, a lot of people do work precarious part-time labor for a minimum wage. So that was sort of the reason they're in. Anyway, this lady who used to be a teacher, her name was Mrs. Smith, she said that this was her Tim Hortons. It was kind of her spot and where she hangs out with her friends and meets up and... has a coffee and chats and things, and she said that as far back as October, that particular Tim Hortons was reorienting things to cut down on breaks and other kind of, you know, ancillary benefits of, you know, also I found this interesting. It used to be, according to this lady, and you know, so unverified, but she said that it used to be that, you know, you worked at Tim Hortons, you could, you know, grab a coffee for your break or grab a coffee on your way out the door on your way home. Apparently, they are disallowing that anymore. So that little perk is not being done anymore at that Tim Hortons. And again, this goes back as far as October, she said. None of this, of course, could be verified by the franchise owner who was there, but was only interacted with the crowd to tell everyone to stay out of the drive-thru and keep it on the sidewalks, you know, I guess for public safety reasons. It was a very wet night. It was a slippery night outside, so. Otherwise,
yeah, and all drive-thrus are hell generally, right? On slippery for sure. Or not, it's like you don't want to be standing there. But yeah, because that was my burning question was, and thanks for the update on that, was that, you know, was this particular location one of the ones that is, quote, bullying workers? Because specifically the one, and it sounds like they had a heck of a turnout, too, the one down the road that's run by the millionaires.
The Royces, who...
the Royces.
Mrs. Royce, who is
Tim Horton's daughter, right?
Yes, her maiden name is actually Horton. So, yeah, that was actually, I was reading the story behind that. It was a self-confessed Luddite who just kind of toys around in social media. And he was somebody who's, you know, one of these retirees who goes to the Tim's and hangs out and grabs a coffee and chats with friends. And he was told by someone who worked there that this is what they were told. And he took a picture of it with his phone and then put it on Facebook. And away we went. And
exploded from there.
Exploded.
Yeah.
So he went viral. I don't know if it was his first time trying to go viral or if he was even trying to go viral, but he went viral. And congratulations to him. It was, so that's the, I guess that was sort of the original sin of post-minimum wage increase, but certainly not the last, I don't think. I think I think what just bothered me especially has been the media coverage. And we did talk about this a bit on the year-end show when I went on a screed about local TV news. And listen to that episode to revisit that. It's really seemed that the prevailing story is that this is bad. You're ruining everything. Minimum wage workers and Kathleen Wynne for giving you a pay increase. It's all your fault. We're going to lose 60,000 jobs because of you. When everyone was quoting this Bank of Canada report about the 60,000 jobs being lost by 2019 when it turns out to be complete hooey. I guess somebody only read the title page and everyone else picked up on it. Actually, it just means that the economic growth in the sector is going to slow by 60,000 jobs. It doesn't mean 60,000 people are going to be out of work. It means that the job growth in that sector is going to be slow, obviously, because you're probably going to be holding on to people longer. There might be less turnover because people are getting like secure pay. Also, I mean, and the flip side of it is, too, that, you know, businesses might be hiring less. You know, not having as much staff on side, but you know, it's. I think the root of this is that it's still to be determined what the effects are going to be, and all this is kind of knee jerk on the part of business, rather than being based on any actual projections. They've been told this is going to negatively affect you, and so they have reacted with that in mind.
Yeah, I think the you know, the usual Chamber of Commerce and the Federation of Independent Business, all three members or whatever, have been making like the same points since 1867, probably. Just oh my God, we're gonna pay them an extra penny an hour. Good Lord, you know, it's that kind of thing. This the arguments haven't changed, and you have to actually strain to find anybody, not the workers as much, but any businesses that that are backing this. But they are out there. There are businesses, and they're usually independent operators who have no problem with this. I think the challenge with the Tim Hortons model is that they're all designed in a certain way. Like it is very assembly line and cookie cutter. So you do need a certain amount of staff to populate that and to have it function properly. So, I mean, and we've all seen it too at Tim Hortons, how rushed they are sometimes.
Absolutely.
And if there's any, you know, cog in that machine that's out of place, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I don't think in the Tim situation we're going to see cutbacks. We have seen in the, or at least the Loblaw group has hinted at it, of course. It's always the millionaires and the billionaires squawking, right? It's like, oh, we're going to go to automated. I mean, they're going to automated checkouts anyway. I think we talked about this before, but automated checkout still needs a person. You still need people to put things on the shelves because we don't have the robots doing it yet.
Right.
So there is a range, and there's also a range too with that 60,000 number. And this is people that don't read beyond headlines and like, oh, they're gonna lose this 60,000 jobs.
Right.
It's, from what I've seen, it's the range of numbers have been offered up, everything from 30,000 to 120,000 on the high end.
And that's nationally too.
Yes, and again, but as you said, it's not like that. Some people are going to lose their jobs. Like this is the possibility of jobs that won't be created is what they're saying.
Right.
And of course, this week we've also found out that the unemployment rate's the lowest it's been, as they're saying, this century.
Yeah.
All 18 years of it. But even so, that's significant. I think it's the lowest it's been in 40 years.
And the December jobs numbers surprised everyone that it was as high as it was gonna, as it ended up being. On top of that, and I'm glad you mentioned it, to go back to the automated teller thing, everyone seems to have forgotten that bread burglar Galen Weston.
The bread burglar.
he's probably not waiting for a reason to go to automated tellers because, you know, people don't realize, and maybe they do realize, and maybe it's not a conscious realization, perhaps it's subconscious. The biggest expense for any business is the people. That's like three quarters of your budget is going to salary and benefits. And in other words, the people making your business a reality. So that's, you know, they're always going to be looking at that overhead because, you know, you're always, when you're trying to cut overhead, you're going to look at the biggest piece of that overhead, which is always the people. So Galen Weston isn't waiting for Kathleen Wynne to raise the minimum wage to find a justification to switch to automated tellers. So let's put that to bed. Bread burglar Galen Weston. I want to start that on Twitter. Hashtag, hashtag bread burglar.
I think next time I'm at Loblaws, I'm just going to go to the automatic checkout and take $25 worth of bread and scan it and see what happens. Probably not a good idea. I would advise it, people, but it's tempting, though. It's very tempting.
Scotty Earth told me to steal this bread.
I want my bread.
Charge it to Scotty Earth. He told me to do it. Anyway, and then the other thing is Tim Hortons. I got this straight from the Tim Hortons site, too. If you want to start your own Tim Hortons franchise, you got to have $1.5 million in assets up to and including, or perhaps in addition, I'm not entirely clear about that because I kind of read it in passing, but you also have to have $500,000 in liquid assets. So on the...
So $2 million on the short end, yeah.
Basically. So you have to have like $500,000 in cash and then $1.5 million in total assets. And then on top of that, you're talking about buying up Tim Hortons, which is basically in Canada a license to print money.
Well, as I said in social media there, they never close. Have you seen one? I've seen one relocated.
Yeah.
I've never seen one shut.
Well,
ever.
Look at Stone Road Mall. They opened like a little Tim Hortons kiosk.
And 100 people lined up at it. Yeah.
Just to serve coffee. It's across the road from like a complete sit-down Tim Hortons. They're both still in business.
Yeah.
Even McDonald's. McDonald's, you know, when you look up on Woolwich, there's an old McDonald's building standing there because that one shut when McDonald's moved into Walmart. You can't sustain two McDonald's on, you know, kitty corner from each other, but you can sustain one Tim Hortons across the road from another Tim Hortons, no problem. And, you know,
plus all of the other coffee that's within reach of there too. So it's not
Treats,
it's very specific
Starbucks
to the brand. It's like, I need my Timmy's.
Williams, all on that corner. It's insane. The other thing is, you were on the Overheard page, right? Overheard at Guelph?
Yes.
Because somebody posted, like, January 2nd, like, I just got a Pizza Hut, and here's note on it that my pizza's going up. Thanks, Kathleen Wynne. And it's just like, you know, I
should be, thanks, Pizza Hut.
But I looked it up. The CEO of Yum, which owns Pizza Hut, KFC, and Taco Bell, makes $22 million a year. Now, I appreciate that, like Tim Hortons, Pizza Hut is a franchise sort of business, so you are essentially talking about people who buy the Pizza Hut name and are small business owners. But Pizza Hut, with a CEO that makes $22 million a year, could, I don't know, do a commensurate cut to franchise fees? That maybe,
that's a lot of pepperoni, $22 million. Yeah,
yeah. So it's just like, it just seems like, and I realize there's also a part of this about the small business, and we're kind of running low on time, so I'll maybe cut this for now. But we'll certainly come back to this. But when it comes to proving that businesses are being punitive to minimum wage earners, it seems to be the big corporations that we're using this as an example instead of the small independent mom and pop shops. So,
well, and they got a 1% cut in the tax rate as well, so it's not as if they're totally hurting. So,
yeah, Bread Burglar's going to be okay. He's gonna inherit the second largest fortune in Canada. Bread Burglar Galen Weston's gonna be okay. Hashtag Bread Burglar. Okay. Speaking
better
of,
call the lawyer after that. Yeah.
Oh, call legal. Goodness. Well, if he gets immunity from the Competition Bureau for bread burgling, I should get immunity for calling him a bread burglar.
I will grant you that immunity.
Thank you.
Speaking of millionaires, I think we got another one on.
Good segue.
Here.
That was exactly where I was going. So Mayor John Tory, Mayor of Toronto. There, you may have noticed it was a bit cold outside the last few weeks. So when it gets really cold outside, it gets really dangerous for people who are homeless. And Toronto shelters were pushing the limit in terms of how many people they could accept. The easy solution has been and was supposed to be opening up the two armories in Toronto in order to house the overflow from the various shelters. John Tory, of course, vociferously shut that down in December. And then when the cold weather hit, it seemed that Toronto was kind of left without a plan. And so they were basically putting people up in motels, which was not any less cost effective, shall we say, than opening up the armories. Anyway.
Yes, John Tory shot it down from his Florida mansion. The exclusive gated golf community of Lost Tree Village. You should see this place that he's staying in where he made the phone call and said, no, Lost Park, not a good idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been standard practice on and off for years to use armories just because of where Moss Park Armory is situated is in a community. It's actually getting fairly gentrified right now at Green and Jarvis. I lived not far from there, let's say. So that is... the most logical spot to do this, plus with an armory has a layout and it has services and a working kitchen and all the things they need. And supposedly this is the, you know, they're using it now and everything's under control. Well, sorry, they were using the Better Living Center at the X, which is also, there's an appropriate name, for a drop in. And now it wasn't full. I think it wasn't at complete capacity, maybe 75%. It sounds like they were still having some logistical information problems as to where to send people. So they got the Better Living Center. Moss Park Armory is going to be temporary because it sounds like they're going to convert the old York Detention Facility, a.k.a. the Juvie, into a more permanent solution. I think they're renovating to take the bars out and to make it more like a hotel, I guess.
More hospitable, less like a jail.
Yeah, because they built a new... it's not new anymore. I think it's called the Salaps, isn't it, in Brampton, that young offenders get it out of the downtown. So steps are being taken, but it sounded like it was a lot of pressure had to be brought to bear. What was the petition was making the rounds? Something like 35,000 people are like, do this, open the armory, just do it.
Yeah, it was like 20,000 back in December, but then it shot way up because people were hashtagging at John Tory, open the armories. And this was, I guess, around New Year's. It was after he came out with his grand pronouncement from Florida. So people were quite incensed at him. And I guess people found the petition and re-upped, and it went up to about 36,000 signatories.
Yeah, and the funny thing about this is when you Google John Tory and homeless, a lot of stories from the UK come up. One of the headlines I got was, Tory, who wanted homeless removed, owns two lavish houses. And I'm thinking, are they talking about John? They're actually talking about an MP in the UK, but it sort of applies too, right?
Right. Like, you don't want to be a man named Tory.
He has an unfortunate last name, and he is a Tory. Although, like, he did a very liberal thing, I think, by kind of caving after initially saying, "Oh, this isn't the best option." Then he's like, "Well, you know." So he was willing to admit. I think his exact words were, "Mistakes were made, and sorry, we're going to try and do better." Which is something that I don't think we would have seen with the previous mayor.
Well,
John probably would have said, "Get a job, you clowns!" But
John Lovink of Spacing wrote a very, I think, pointed editorial about this. How it was basically putting a pin in this very carefully cultivated image of John Tory as like a socially not progressive but socially willing to listen to like the socially progressive side, like this very fine line he's walking down, because he's a red Tory, he's a true blue conservative, and I think people have forgotten that, because we know what the alternative looks like when you're talking about conservatism in Toronto. So, and John Tory also attenuated himself because he wanted to get the people who were leaning towards Olivia Chow in the last election in order to broaden his base to make sure he beat whatever Ford he ended up having to
pick your Ford, any Ford, yeah.
Right? And I think this is kind of the big problem that is going to come down to the pike and is going to color this coming election, is that because our friend of the show Desmond Cole is someone who's there's like a draft Desmond Cole movement, and he's seems quite open to the possibility, and says he's been discussing it with
That'd
people.
Be a
he
very
trusts.
Interesting race,
right?
Sure.
But again, we come to the same problem, which is there's going to be a Ford in the race, someone who does not appreciate, you know, wonkish sort of insights, who doesn't consider data, who thinks that, you know, media is elitist and, you know, that we shouldn't listen to experts and elites, and his own gut leads the way. And it's going to come down to this again. It's like it's going to come down to, are we going to have a wholesome conversation about where people want to take the city of Toronto, or is it going to be about defeating another doofus Ford brother? And I don't want that.
No. And I think a lot of cities, an extension from this, have to have their own conversation about homelessness.
Absolutely.
A bit of a movement in Stratford, a petition making the rounds there. It's like, can we work on this? Same with Guelph. I believe there was an article this past week, and I was surprised at how low the numbers seemed. It may not be completely accurate, and that they were saying there was like 50 was the number. So if that's the case, you should be able to find spaces for 50 people in this town, no problem. And I guess maybe that's a discussion for another time, but...
There's some trickiness with how the shelters, though, in Guelph run, because I've talked to people who have had that experience, and you get, you know, you get your 28 days, but then you can't go back for... I mean, and I'm sure they make allowances in case of, like, weather emergencies, like extreme cold, but it's not a system where you need somewhere to sleep. They provide that, you know, it's you get your 28 days and then you're on your own again for like 3 months. And then on top of that, you are on your own for most of the day, which mostly means being out in the cold all day.
And there doesn't seem to be any permanent social housing on the horizon in this town, more condos.
That's right.
So I think until there's some sort of movement towards that, we're just going to see more of the same. Mm-hmm. And I hope there may be some change on the horizon. I really hope that it's going to be an election issue this year, because it's never on the docket. It's always something else. And I think it really needs to come to the forefront, considering, the temperature, well, not even just the temperatures, regardless of whether it's +9 as it is today or -30, it's like there shouldn't be anybody homeless in this town that isn't by choice. So
yeah, that'll be the last word, and we're back for another year four, the year we finally get it right. So Scott isn't laughing. Okay, now he's like, okay, good. It was delayed reaction.
From a distance. Ha, ha, ha.
Good. Yes. So with all the latest developments with the show, stick with us. We're at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, you can download all episodes of Open Sources Guelph from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean. And you can find it by searching Guelph Politicast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can find me at Adam A. Donson on Twitter and Instagram, and I'm at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter. I blog at the Spanner Book, spannerbook.wordpress.com, and hopefully I will not be viral next week and back in studio. And I think I'm going to have to take a vow of silence for the next 24 hours, because I've blown a vocal cord. So.
Yeah, save it for Spanner Book.
I'm going to cover some Leonard Cohen songs and put out my own CD, I think. See you later, kids.
Oh, Scotty is waiting for a miracle for that. That's cool, right? Bad Leonard Cohen music puns. So we'll leave that for DJ Sounds Good to Me. She'll have some music puns coming up here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and Scotty... we'll be back in the flesh, hopefully. I will likely be back in the flesh unless I get the canine flu next week here on Open Sources Guelph, Thursdays at 5 p.m. on CFRU, and we will see you next week.